Case number 13-7088, DaVinci Sanallah-Hirani et al., appellants versus Alexander V. Mirchev et al. Mr. Foster for the appellants, Mr. Lampkin for the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Howard Foster for the plaintiff's appellants, the Hiranis. This case is about the extraterritorial application of the RICO statute. The district court dismissed the case believing that what we have alleged here is an extraterritorial application, and under the Supreme Court's decision in Morrison, the case had to be dismissed because there was no power to decide it. That was wrong.
Can I ask you a fact question before you get going? When did Mr. Hirani become a U.S. citizen?
Mr. Hirani, DaVinci Hirani, is a U.S. citizen and has been one since before this whole case arose, before 2007. I don't know what year.
Before the activities at issue here or before the litigation arose?
Before the activities at issue, he was a naturalized U.S. citizen. All of the relevant activities occurred in the United States, except for the actual holdup, seizure of the assets, which took place in Kazakhstan when the co-conspirator actually told Mr. Hirani to turn over your stock in this company or we're going to keep harassing you. And he signed a paper and he turned it over. And the district judge believed that because that actual activity occurred in Kazakhstan, the whole case was extraterritorial.
Can you tell us, detail more, the conduct that you're relying on that you say is determinative that did occur in the United States?
Sure, Judge Pillard. The whole scheme was concocted by two people. Mr. Mirchev, who is an American citizen and lives in Washington, D.C., and Daraga Nabarayev, if I'm pronouncing her last name correctly, who is in Kazakhstan. The two of them
were... Daraga was in Kazakhstan the whole time.
She was in Kazakhstan.
She didn't come and consult with Mirchev here.
She consulted with him by phone.
By phone.
Yeah, she was not physically here as far as we know, although she may have been. She has been to the United States, according to internet stories, a number of times. But the allegations are that the two of them worked closely together to formulate the scheme to take the Hirani's oil company. That scheming went on here by Mr. Mirchev in his office and over there by her in her office. They worked together. They had worked together on prior projects. They have a close working relationship. The whole thing was hatched. We're not suing her. We're only suing Mr. Mirchev. And on the particular day in question, in 2007, she met with DaVinci Hirani, the U.S. citizen, in her office and told him to sign a piece of paper and turn over his control of his oil companies to her, which he did. That couldn't have happened had she not closely worked with Mr. Mirchev in preparing the whole thing from his office here in Washington. So
what else? What about proceeds, Krull Corporation?
Right. Yeah, all the proceeds went through I think the court is aware of this. The case was dismissed prior to any discovery based on a 12B6 motion. So we have scant detail. And from what we know, a lot of money was taken out of those oil companies. It went through Daraga, and then a great deal of it was wired to Mr. Murchov, and he laundered it into his bank accounts here, and he's holding it. Now, I can't be more particular about the amounts of money or the dates or so forth without discovery, but he's got a lot of the money here, and he was instrumental in the movement of that money and in the laundering of that money and in holding of that money here in Washington.
What did you mean when you said he agreed to monetize these assets when she took them from the folks in Kazakhstan? What did monetize mean?
Well, on the international currency markets, money is worth a lot more if it's in U.S. dollars than if it is in the Kazakh currency.
I'm sorry, did she liquidate these?
She liquidated a lot of the oil companies. Yes, sold assets. And she wanted.
I thought we were talking about Alma Media and KTV or whatever it was over there because she wanted. She wanted to be able to control the presentation under your theory, of course, of her image going forward. Those weren't liquidated.
She did liquidate these companies. She sold a lot of assets in the companies. She wanted the money, but I can't say all of it. I don't know that. But she wanted money to be exchanged into U.S. dollars, and that she could not do. She needed Mr. Murchov to do that. That's what I mean by monetize into U.S. dollars.
But the exchange into U.S.
exchange
into U.S. dollars didn't injure your clients. Your clients were only injured by the loss of their property in Kazakhstan.
That is correct, Judge Miller.
And that's why you've identified the Hobbs Act extortion as your RICO predicates that have allegedly injured your clients.
Yes.
And
that's correct.
The acts of extortion, every element of the act of extortion took place in Kazakhstan.
Well, the act of the conspiracy to do the extortion took place here.
But isn't it under governing law the case that the location of a conspiracy is the location of the act that's being conspired?
No, it's the location of the conspiracy is the location of the conspiracy. And where the act is actually carried out doesn't change the fact that the U.S. has jurisdiction to prosecute the conspiracy.
What's your best case for that?
Cosmentino, the Supreme Court case, which 2005, which involved wire fraud to Canada. The Supreme Court held that the act was complete at the moment the conspiracy was formed here.
But all the acts to undertake the fraud were also all the wire fraud actions were also took place in the United States.
All the acts in that case, yes, the actual initiation of a wire, the use of a wire took place in the United States.
The plotting of the fraud, when going to get to Canada if it didn't start if they didn't initiate it here.
True, but
but that's a big difference here, right? Because you have your substantive offenses are extortion.
Yes.
And that, all the elements of the, put aside conspiracy for a section, all the elements of the extortion, the threat, coerce, et cetera, to take someone's property away, all happened in Kazakhstan.
The threat, yes, the threat, the actual act in 2007 took place in Kazakhstan. The idea to do that was formed here by Mr. Murchov.
So what's your test? What do we look at? Because I thought we looked at what was the focus of congressional concern, and in this case, it would be the focus of congressional concern in enacting the Hobbs Act. And so if the focus of congressional concern is to prevent people from having, you know, death threats leveled against them as a way of taking their property, that conduct that occurred in Kazakhstan, or is there a different focus of congressional concern that you would be pointing to that the Hobbs Act addressed?
The Hobbs Act made the conspiracy to commit a violation a substantive violation.
But see, you mentioned Pasquantino, but I don't think Pasquantino supports your case because Pasquantino is using precisely the rule that I posited, which is that the location of the conspiracy is the location where the substantive crimes occurred in that case. And if it's in the U.S., then fine, the conspiracy in the U.S. But here, if by hypothesis the Hobbs Act violation is in Kazakhstan, the fact that some conspiratorial conduct relating to that violation occurred in the United States, I don't think moves it.
Well,
I want you to address that.
Sure. Pasquantino was not a Hobbs Act case. It was a wire fraud case, mm-hmm. yeah. But let's look at European Community. I think, Judge, that addresses your question better than Pasquantino, because there, all of the preparatory acts to deprive these European countries of their tax revenues occurred in the U.S. The actual harm, the deprivation of revenue, occurred in Europe. But the Second Circuit said that was not extraterritorial.
And
the violation, well, the relevant acts there were wire fraud, and the wires were used in...
But you have to be more precise, right? You have to look at what the reach of the U.S. law is, and the wire fraud is, the reach is much broader, and in fact would criminalize as a matter of U.S. domestic law conduct that reaches Europe, whereas the question I think that we're pressing on is, what about the Hobbs Act violation makes this Hobbs Act violation domestic?
There have been previous Hobbs Act cases, which we cited, like Kaplan, in which are right on point. Conspiracies to commit extortions in Panama, conspiracies to commit extortions carried out in Saudi Arabia, that's BCCI, which the district court in the District of Columbia held was not extraterritorial. That was prosecuted in a civil RICO case. I think those are right on the money.
But I guess I'm trying to figure out how those fit as even substantive violations of the Hobbs Act. Because you have to have obstruct, delay, or affect commerce. And
yes.
Commerce is defined carefully in the Hobbs Act and does not include foreign commerce. What commerce was obstructed, delayed, or affected by robbery or extortion in your case?
The commerce was the commerce between, it does include foreign commerce.
It's not
interstate or foreign.
Not the definition of commerce in the Hobbs Act. It's not.
Well, Judge.
1951 B3.
I would point the court to Kaplan, which addressed that, the 11th Circuit case that we cited in our brief.
But Kaplan is pre-Morrison, and it is also an 11th Circuit case, but
yes.
It's pre-Morrison.
It's pre-Morrison, but there was a very careful analysis that the court held that the Hobbs Act, commerce was very broad, and commerce would include anything that started in the U.S.
Right.
So the plot to
but
carry
so this
out...
Didn't, so this extortion didn't start... in the U.S. Because the reason I'm doing this, because you keep resorting to the conspiracy, but it's a conspiracy so to do. And so the so to do is obstruct, delay, or affect commerce.
Yes.
Which, as I read it, is defined as territorial commerce within the United States. And so I don't think the conspiracy can bootstrap you into a violation of the Hobbs Act if the substantive activities, obstruct, delay, or affecting commerce, is only affecting Kazakhstan commerce.
Well, it's affecting U.S. commerce.
And how's that?
Because the scheme was actually to move all that money to Mr.
But you conceded that didn't injure you, and you have to have a predicate act that injured you. So if you don't have a predicate act that injured you anywhere in the United States, and you don't have a Hobbs Act predicate extortion that occurred in the United States and thus falls within the Hobbs Act at all, then I don't simply saying that after the fact they agreed to move the money in is going to get you anywhere.
Well, the extortion scheme started with Mr. Murchov here. I mean, he devised a scheme to extort money from Mr. Harani, who's a U.S. citizen. It's his money.
Do you have a theory? I mean, I know I asked you this, and I'm just not sure that I caught your answer. On to the extent that what we're directed to look at is, what was the focus of Congress's concern in enacting the Hobbs Act? What kind of conduct, what was the wrong that Congress was addressing there?
Threats.
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 And that occurred?
The threat occurred
in Kazakhstan
based on a conspiracy between an American and a person in Kazakhstan to execute the threat. Conspirators have always been guilty.
But hang on. The Supreme Court has told us it's not the threat that's extortion. It is the threat and the obtaining of property.
Yes.
So it has to be a threatened obtaining of property.
Yes.
So it's not just the threats. So the fact that he planned threats here doesn't mean anything, even if under the allegations. What you have to look at is where was the threatened obtaining of property. And I take it from your complaint that was only in Kazakhstan?
The Supreme Court says, Scheidler, there must be an attempt to take property or taking property. That physically occurred in Kazakhstan? Absolutely. But it was based on a conspiracy between two people, and the Supreme Court has recognized conspiracies to commit extortion. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court allows each person who conspired to commit the extortion to be indicted, to be sued in a civil RICO case. They don't both have to personally have their hands on the property at the time it's taken.
I have an antecedent question that I'd like to ask you, and it's about Judge Hogan's footnote 9, where he says you haven't sufficiently alleged an enterprise. That's antecedent to all of this, right?
That's just plainly wrong.
You think it's plainly wrong? He says plaintiffs failed to plead any evidence showing that defendants utilized Kroll Corporation to advance the extortion. And he says the laundering doesn't make it that. So why is that so plainly wrong?
He's actually making, I think, two points. Not that we didn't allege an enterprise. We did. The corporation is a Washington, D.C. corporation. That's an enterprise. I think that Judge Hogan's point was he thought the
enterprise has to be used in the RICO conspiracy.
No, it doesn't. There's nothing that says the enterprise has to be used to commit the predicate act. The enterprise can be a victim. It can be a victim because a corporation can be used, as the Supreme Court said in Cedric Kushner, and Judge Hogan didn't recognize this, in a way that by a person to help carry out illegal activities, and that's the type of use of an enterprise that the statute was intended to combat.
You've sued under 62C, which requires a showing that they conducted the enterprise's affairs through a pattern of racketeering.
Yes.
How did you allege that they conducted through Kroll the pattern of extortion?
Because Mr. Mirchov is using Kroll Corporation as a shield to cover up his crimes. He's using it as just a basic legitimate sounding enterprise.
The only thing I saw in the complaint about Kroll, and we're talking about paragraphs 13, 29, and 31, the allegations about Kroll boil down to Dariga, is that her name? Retained the services.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
They retained the services, and defendant was paid through Kroll.
Right.
That's it.
Kroll Corporate.
What else is there?
Kroll Corporation was used by Mr. Mirchov to give him the patina of legitimacy to conduct his businesses. Just as in Cedric Kushner,
but what does that have to do
King
with the
ran an illegal business through his company.
What does that have to do with the – I mean, your injury is from the extortion. And
yes.
So if the enterprise in this case didn't have anything to do with the extortion.
Right.
How can that be an enterprise for purposes of your RICO lawsuit as opposed to some separate money laundering thing?
He couldn't have done this without a
couldn't
business.
Couldn't have done what? What's
without this? Pardon me?
What is it this that he couldn't have done without Kroll?
He couldn't have done the extortion. He couldn't be in business as a consultant and even be operating without a corporate entity. He's using this corporate entity to shield his illegal activities.
To shield his conspiring with her about doing the threats.
Yes, to shield the fact that he does a lot of illegal activities. He uses
We're not here to talk about anything else other than the extortion.
I understand
the
that.
Money laundering, so we don't need to reference that. So it's a shield. I'm trying to figure out, because I didn't see this in the complaint, what Kroll had to do with just the extortion. Can you point me to the complaint where it says Kroll had something to do with the extortion?
No. The complaint says that Mr. Mirchov is using this corporation to help him conduct illegal business. It gives him a patina of respectability to keep inquiries and investigations away from him. He uses a legitimate-sounding corporate entity. That makes the corporation a victim. That theory of enterprise has been accepted by this court in Philip Morris, by the Supreme Court in Cedric Kushner. It's not necessary to show.
All right. My second antecedent question has to do with the continuity test and how you distinguish this case from Edmondson, where in Edmondson, like here, there was only a couple of victims and a few victims and one single discrete injury. It looks just like Edmondson.
No, it's not, Judge Taylor. This has gone on for years. You don't need multiple.
I know you talk about the time, but what about this?
You don't need more than one victim to have a pattern of racketeering activity, mm-hmm. although we have alleged more than one victim here. Okay. We have alleged four.
Do you have any other questions?
No. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. Jeff Lamkin on behalf of Dr. Alexander Murchev and the Kroll Corporation. All the issues in this case, from extraterritoriality to active state to the pleading deficiencies, to sanctions, all to stem from the unavoidable fact the complaint alleges threats in Kazakhstan by Kazakhstanis, coerced consent in Kazakhstan to obtain Kazakhstan assets and their placement in a Kazakhstan government fund. Plaintiffs have disavowed any claim to apply RICO.
Is it Kazakhstan government fund in the U.S. or in Kazakhstan?
Kazakhstan, Your Honor. Plaintiffs have disavowed any effort to apply RICO abroad. As a result, their complaint must be dismissed unless this is a domestic application of RICO. But plaintiffs' invocation of RICO here is clearly extraterritorial for three distinct reasons. First, if you erase from the complaint everything that happened abroad or in Kazakhstan, there's virtually nothing left. You have one half of an allegedly conspiratorial phone call in the United States. That's just too slender a read to convert what is essentially a Kazakhstan-based dispute and Kazakhstan-centric actions into a U.S. set, a domestic application of RICO.
Does the Hobbs Act apply if this taking of property occurs overseas? Does it apply to foreign commerce?
So the first part of the answer is, by the stipulation here, I don't think it does, because mm-hmm. plaintiffs have said we're not seeking to apply Hobbs Act extraterritorially. And if the predicate, if the acts that are substantively prohibited by the Hobbs Act, the extortion, the taking of property, the threats, don't extend abroad, then the conspiracy to do so wouldn't apply either. It's sort of a standard principle of criminal conspiracy law that when you have a set of statutory prohibitions, and a prohibition on conspiracy to do so, if the object of the conspiracy wouldn't violate the statutory prohibitions, nor does the conspiracy provision. And that's how the Hobbs Act reads, because it talks about the obstruction of commerce and specific acts, robbery and extortion. And then it says, or a conspiracy so to do. And if those acts, the robbery and extortion, don't actually apply abroad,
they're going to tell me that stipulation is perfectly fine because this happened here in some way, and so I'm just trying to figure out as a baseline, does the Hobbs Act apply?
Apart from the stipulation, the short answer is, even aside from the stipulation, we don't think the Hobbs Act applies extraterritorially.
Well,
not since Morris.
If it doesn't apply, I mean, I think you're right in framing the question as, is this a domestic violation of the Hobbs Act? But I don't think that just pointing to the fact that some conduct occurred overseas and some in the U.S., and you think on balance the conduct over there was more important. Like, that's not the test. And I guess I love your answer to what you think is the test. I thought it was the Morrison idea of what is the focus of Congress's concern in enacting the Hobbs Act. And just to tip my hand further about my thinking, this is not state law extortion. This is federal extortion. And one understanding of why Congress kicked it upstairs and created a federal crime of extortion is to protect commerce. And, there is an argument that this is happening, that the Hobbs Act violations happen in the United States because of $500 million extortion, that the threats, fulcrum of which is occurring in Kazakhstan, affects U.S. commerce.
I think it would be somewhat fanciful to think that Congress in 1947 was seeking to establish the Hobbs Act and apply it to address threats in Kazakhstan that result in the transfer of property within Kazakhstan.
Okay, now give me a better answer.
So the focus, I don't think the focus of the Hobbs Act is extortion overseas. It was union strife that was going on in the United States.
Well, extortion that affects commerce, the commerce that the Commerce Clause is concerned with. And are you saying that there's no argument that the commerce that's affected by this conduct is U.S. commerce?
The extortion itself, I don't think you can find a direct effect on U.S. commerce.
I think that the money came into the U.S.
That Kroll Corporation or Dr. Merchant were paid from some of the proceeds incidentally.
And that there's a money laundering count also, or money laundering claim.
Right.
And that's money that's being laundered through the U.S.
Right. Now, the money laundering
claim. A lot of money.
I think, the money laundering claim for the United States, or the money laundering claim, is only a domestic money laundering claim. It's the claim that comes to the United States. And
right.
It doesn't allege, it says there's concealment, but it doesn't tell us what the concealment is. So I don't even think they have a money laundering claim, because under Iqbal, you have to say what the acts of concealment are. It says it was concealed because it was put into U.S. bank accounts. But the most natural inference from someone putting money in U.S. bank accounts is to have access to the United States. But coming back to the effect on commerce, the Congress's focus may have been on commerce, but the acts it was regulating, what are the focus of the acts it's regulating to affect commerce? The acts it's actually regulating, the conduct at issue, is the extortion which has an effect on commerce. And that extortion all occurred abroad here.
But why didn't it affect commerce if he's a U.S. citizen? So if someone takes, if I happen to have some piece of property over in London, and I'm sitting here, and that's one of my assets, probably the IRS has figured out a way to tax it, and someone takes it away in London, doesn't that affect my commerce as a citizen of the United States, my ability to engage in commerce back here?
I think, Judge Millett, the answer is Congress can enact laws that follow U.S. citizens wherever they are, but those are by nature their sort of extraterritorial laws, that the prohibitions and protections follow the U.S. citizen wherever they are. The bottom line is, when you're looking at whether something's extraterritorial, the question is Congress regulating conduct that's in a foreign country such that you could have the effects that the rule against extraterritorial application could be offended? So, for example,
I'm asking a more simple question. That is whether U.S. commerce is affected when a U.S. citizen's property is taken away from it, even if that property happens to be overseas. Doesn't that affect U.S. commerce?
No, I don't think it would, Your Honor, because there's no indication of whether or not that money is going to come back to the United States or just stay abroad. The fact that it's a U.S. citizen strikes me as largely irrelevant.
But here we have allegations of a U.S. citizen who's a great deal of money is being extorted from him and being put into accounts in the United States.
That some small amount of the proceeds was paid to Dr. Merchup as a result.
I think there was more than that. That money was being laundered through accounts in the United States.
No, I think there's two sets of complaints regarding the process of money, two set of allegations. There's one in pages 29 to 32, paragraphs 29 to 32, that are denominated money laundering. And those are just the monies that were paid to Dr. Merchup as his fee. And as I said before, those just don't address, they don't mention concealment. There's also a mention
They don't mention what?
They say concealment. There's concealment is that there's concealed, but there's no facts alleged. And so it fails under Iqbal for that reason. But turning back, the other set, and I think this is one that Judge Hogan pointed to, apparently one of the allegations of the conspiracy is that he would help DeRiga monetize the assets, buy Western currencies, things like that. But that isn't alleged to have actually occurred, and it is not denominated money laundering. So all the international conduct involving whatever the proceeds were isn't alleged to be money laundering in this case. It's just alleged to be part of the conspiracy. The money laundering itself, 29 to 32, clear as can be, nothing but Dr. Merchev's share or proceeds. But if I could back up just for a moment on the scope of extraterritoriality, the whole point is what you're looking at when you're asking, are we applying a statute extraterritorially? You're asking, are we applying U.S. law to foreign conduct such that we could create a conflict with foreign law? So if we imagine in this case that everything that happened in Kazakhstan was just fine in a matter of Kazakhstan law, it's all perfectly lawful, then it's absolutely clear that what plaintiffs are doing here and what they have to do to prevail is to label conduct in Kazakhstan a violation of the U.S. Hobbs Act. They're trying to regulate the conduct in Kazakhstan under the Hobbs Act. And they're not only doing that, but they're saying that President Nazarbayev and his daughter Dariga's conduct in Kazakhstan are violations of U.S. law.
When we do the Morrison test and we look for the purpose, do we look at the statute? Do we look at the section of the statute? Which statute do we look at, RICO or Hobbs Act? here? Because in Morrison they looked at Rule 10b sometimes and they looked at the Securities Act sometimes. So I'm not even sure what I'm supposed to look at.
I think Morrison is, because it looks to the statutory focus, it's somewhat indeterminate and it doesn't provide us a whole lot of guidance as to what you look at. But I think in a case, in this case, we'd be looking at the purposes of RICO and civil RICO in particular. And the focus of civil RICO, the heart of civil RICO, as the Supreme Court said in agency holdings, are the predicate acts. Where do the injurious predicate acts occur? And Beck versus Prufus teaches us that conspiracy alone is not actionable, not either as a general matter or under civil RICO.
The position of the U.S. government is they don't want to just look at Racketeering Act. They think you should look at the enterprise as well, because we don't want people looking, you know, doing their criminal stuff and then spoiling enterprises here in the United States. For example, your victimization of a business. And so why are they incorrect when they argue that the problem here is the enterprise was in the U.S.?
I think the enterprise test is just wrong for four distinct reasons, and no court of appeals has adopted it, I think, for these four reasons. And the first is it's just a terrible fit with the purpose of extraterritoriality. The purpose of the rule against extraterritoriality is to prevent conflict. It results when U.S. laws are applied to conduct abroad. But if you use the enterprise test, if the enterprise is in the U.S., then U.S. law is going to apply and RICO will apply to conduct that occurs wholly within China, even if it's perfectly lawful in China. That creates exactly the conflicts that the rule against extraterritoriality is supposed to avoid. The enterprise test sort of dispenses with the entire purpose behind the rule. Second,
I think that kind of begs the question, because the whole reason we ask what the statute is focused on is to see whether the political branches have made the call that they want to step a little bit on foreign countries because of what they identify to be supervening domestic interests. And so if the inquiry is, have they thought about, you know, is their real concern here is protecting enterprises, then we have to assume that they thought about the consequences of bad things happening overseas that affect enterprises here.
I think that actually crosses up two questions. One is, did Congress intend the law to apply extraterritorially? And that is, did the Congress and the executive branch take it into account and say, yes, we've decided. The law is going to apply abroad. We don't care about offending China. And a second question, which is, when you're looking at a law that's domestic, is the application the plaintiff's asserting domestic or extraterritorial? And when you're deciding that, am I trying to apply a purely domestic law abroad, you ask, is it regulating conduct abroad? And the conduct being regulated abroad in this case.
I don't think that's really precise enough. I mean, a lot of domestic law applied domestically regulates or affects conduct abroad and conduct here. I mean, we live in a very interconnected world. And so I thought that, you know, the court was trying to be a little bit more precise about it in saying in Morrison that we should look at what kinds of, you know, yeah. Conduct, and it's not just conduct, but what harms to United States interests the law is getting at. And that's different from looking in the sort of physicalistic way that you're suggesting, you know, this happened there, this happened here.
I think I should be more precise, but I also think it's quite the reverse. I should be more precise in the sense that this first step is you look at the focus of the law.
Yeah.
And then you say, when I focus on that law, is the stuff that affects that focus, the substantive
exactly.
thing we're trying to prohibit, did that all occur abroad, or did that occur
exactly.
here? So in Morrison itself,
right.
there were outright fraudulent lies in the United States from the state of Florida. But the court decided that the focus of the law wasn't about fraud and lies and things like that. It was about sales of securities, and that all occurred abroad.
Exchange, right. And exchange. So the question is, does commerce stand in the Hobbs Act, stand in the same position as an exchange did in Morrison?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think substantive conduct, not the effects of it. Because if Congress had simply, if you should simply say anything affecting commerce is good enough to make this.
Well, extortions good. Affecting commerce.
Or any
extortions, because that's what the Hobbs Act is about. So extortions yeah. that affect U.S. commerce.
I think, Judge Pillard, that theory would render the prohibition on extraterritorial application meaningless, because almost all commerce legislation, whatever the conduct is, affects commerce in some way. And so then any conduct anywhere in the world that affects commerce, well, we're protecting commerce, and therefore it's a domestic application rather than an extraterritorial one. I think it renders the whole distinction meaningless. But I think you need to focus, what the court would focus on is, what are the acts we're regulating? What's the actual physical conduct? And does that conduct occur abroad or the United States?
Okay.
Focus on Congress's concern. The acts it wanted to regulate was abroad.
Okay.
Then the conduct is extraterritorial.
I just wonder if you had other reasons why the enterprise argument was the wrong focus. You had four, and you only got one out.
Well, I think the second one was the one that I had been just talking about with Judge Pillard, which is what's the focus of the statute in question. And the focus of RICO is the predicate acts. In civil RICO in particular, the predicate acts that injure you. And here there's just no injurious predicate act in the United States. Conspiracy under Beck cannot be your source of injury. You have to look to the improper or independently wrongful acts pursuant to the conspiracy. And all the independently wrongful acts pursuant to conspiracy, every one of them occurred, not here, but in Kazakhstan. The third is it's inconsistent with RICO's text. Section 1961 of RICO requires the conduct to be indictable. If you apply that, that means that it would not apply to a RICO predicate that's purely domestic. As it occurred abroad, it would not be indictable. But if you look at the enterprise test and say, where was the enterprise? Even conduct that's not indictable because it occurred wholly abroad falls within the enterprise test. It becomes domestic. And so you end up blowing a gigantic hole in this textual limit in Section 1961. And the final one is that I think that either the enterprise test becomes so plastic as to be meaningless, or it becomes leads to absurd results. And that's, there's two.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Foster, I think you're out of town, but time, but you can have 1 minute.
I'd like to make 2 points. I think what counsel's argument really boils down to is a U.S. citizen cannot sue another U.S. citizen for stealing his money. That's what their argument is. That's absurd. Nobody has ever said that. The Supreme Court has never said that. This court has never said that. That couldn't be the law. It's not under Morrison. My second point is the enterprise, the location of the enterprise, should be a part of the analysis of extraterritoriality because it was the object of Congress's solicitude, which is what Morrison said should be the way of looking at extraterritoriality. RICO was enacted in large part to protect enterprises from being used by criminals.
What if we think there's a tie between enterprise here, predicate acts there? What's the tiebreaker?
The tiebreaker? Well, the predicate act has got to tilt somewhat towards the U.S., which it does through the conspiracy here. If the predicate act were looked purely as a foreign act, I would say you've got to also consider the location of the enterprise. One doesn't have to, we don't have to use one test exclusively. We can look at both factors.
Right, and I said if they come out, if they point in opposite directions, then
the tiebreaker? How about I think the enterprise is more important because we're dealing with U.S. citizens.
All right.
Thank you for your
time.
Thank
you very much. Case is submitted.